didn't just pick a handful of people and say, I'm going to make their lives miserable. I'm going to make my life miserable because I'm going to have to focus on them for the next 10, 12 years, whatever. No, we're trying to get justice for Eric Cross by pointing out their fault and what they did to create this boy's death.
Hello everyone and welcome to Crime Valley. I'm your host Amber and today's episode is part two in the murder of Eric Sterling Cross. Just like in episode one, I will be using my interview with Missy Hatfield to assist in telling Eric's story. We left off at the end of episode one with the police trying to piece together the circumstances which led to Eric's horrific death. We talked about teenager Bill Cook. Bill was the boy Eric was meant to be having a sleepover with, the boy who called Eric his best friend. We wondered at the reason why Bill never turned up at Eric's house the morning after the party, the morning he had plans to attend a boat show in Detroit with Eric and his dad. I also introduced the group of teenagers known as the Core Group, who back in 1983, people all around Vicksburg were linking to Eric's murder. Eric's funeral was held, and as you would expect, many people came to show their respects. Two of the people in attendance were Amber Thomas and Maybrit Spaulding.
At his funeral, they broke down. They were just sobbing and just destroyed at the funeral. The two of them huddled together and hugging and crying like a family member should have cried, kind of a breakdown like a mom or somebody would do, you know. But they put on a big show, and Eric's mom actually was moved because she saw how Maybrit and Amber were just destroyed by this, and they're like, wow, you know, Eric did matter to people, and it's so sad and stuff. And this was early, obviously still early, because the investigation's only a few days old. She didn't know that they were part of this yet. And then years later, when she found that out, it's like, you know, I just can't imagine being his mom, losing this boy in such a horrific way, and then to think that these girls were good people that really cared about her son, and then to find out, oh my gosh, they were actually part of this?
Just 2 days after Eric's death, another graduation party had been thrown. Brent and his friends arrived at this party but never made it up the driveway. Witnesses saw a heated argument erupt between the group of teenagers before they all promptly left. Others spoke about a pool party that was held in the preceding weeks. It seemed that the cracks were starting to form in the silence surrounding Eric's murder.
At a party, a couple days later, because there were several graduation parties that whole week and pool parties and things like that, because it was like, you know, beginning of summer vacation. There was another situation where someone came forward and said that, actually it was someone from a different school district and everything, that were invited over and didn't really know the situation. He's like, you know, I'm talking to this guy and he's telling me that, I went to this pool party but all the girls weren't out at the pool. It was just guys out there. And I'm like, what's going on? And he said that all the girls were huddled into this one room in the house, and you could hear somebody crying, and somebody came out and said, oh, yeah, Amber's falling apart in there. The girls are all helping her. So right there, she broke down about Eric and what happened. None of those girls will come forward.
After the summer break, school started back, and life returned to normal for some. For the grieving Cross family, their new version of normal involved moving Jackie to a new school. They had heard the talk that was raging through Vicksburg, the talk that almost always centered on a group of teenagers who had attended Vicksburg High School with Eric. Ted and Mary Lou Cross did not want their daughter exposed to the very people that the town was saying had murdered their son, so they made the decision to enroll Jackie at another school.
Eric's sister was going to go to a different school, but then the younger siblings of the people involved actually went to a different school, and the day that Jackie's parents were signing her up to go to a different school, they were like, somebody in that office had mentioned that there were other kids coming from Vicksburg, and her parents were like, well, who are they? And when they heard the last names, they're like, well, then she's not going to go here. And they took her back to Vicksburg thinking, okay, well, they've taken their kids out of Vicksburg, so Jackie can go here.
Well, unfortunately, one of them stayed because her dad was on the school board, and that was Brent's girlfriend, Amber. And then there was, within a short amount of time, another one of the kids came back because it wasn't being discussed in school as far as it wasn't a big deal because Amber was okay, so they brought one of the, they brought May Britt back. And then, like, a short amount of time after that, Tim's younger sister came back, and Brent's younger brother came back. So all of a sudden, Jackie went from only dealing with one of them to having, four of them around her through school. And kids were trying to be helpful, but they'd come up to Jackie, and they're like, you know, that's who killed your brother, right? And she would just have to hear this constantly from kids that they were meaning well. They wanted to help, and they're like, you know, when you're like 13, 14, up to 17, even 18, it doesn't totally make sense to you sometimes. Like, I know who did it. They're right there, and you're pointing at them, and it's like, why isn't anyone listening?
Law enforcement had tried to get to the bottom of what happened to Eric, and they certainly seemed to have their suspicions. When it came to persons of interest, they kept hearing the same group of names being mentioned over and over again. Brent Spaulding was always at the forefront of these rumours, and many believed that he was the ringleader of the group and the instigator of the violence against Eric. When Brent Spaulding's car suddenly disappeared soon after Eric's murder, people were suspicious. Where had Brent's car gone? Why would a boy who had just graduated from high school suddenly be without his mode of transport? Why had it seemingly vanished off the face of the earth without a logical explanation? It was a strange scenario. A boy is murdered, and the murder weapon is a vehicle. When, in quick succession to the murder, the dead boy's known bully suddenly misplaces his car. Well, I guess that you have to ask yourself, how much do you believe in coincidences? Brent's missing car became the stuff of urban legend. The biggest story that is still perpetuated to this day is that Brent's vehicle ended up in Florida. The Spauldings had family down there, and it probably would have been their best option if they had wanted to misplace something as big as a car. Although May Britt and Brent's father, Brian Sr., refused to let police speak to his children, police did speak to others in the group of friends.
In 1983, there were 3 lie detectors given, and all came back not truthful, so they failed their lie detectors. And there were, I've personally read 2 witness statements, one from Tim and one from Bill. And basically, Bill said, yes, I was there, but if I say anything, I'll end up like Eric. But the lie detectors, the questions they asked and the write-up and stuff, it all showed that they were deceitful. And then you take the lie detector and you put it against their written statements, and you can tell, you can literally read like bullet points of lies right down through those. Tim's was the same thing. Amber's was similar. But they were all of them had lied in 1983, but Spaulding didn't allow his kids to be interviewed by the police. No lie detectors. He lawyered right up. And then shortly after these guys went in, I think at least Amber, I'm sure her parents lawyered up too, to protect their daughter, which, again, getting a lawyer, that's fine and that's understandable because you should protect your rights.
By October of 1983, the core group that people believed were responsible for Eric's murder was well and truly talking. Not to the police, but they were talking nonetheless. Perhaps it was cathartic for them to confide in others. They were a group of teenagers completely out of their depth and in the middle of a very adult situation. While many of the teens' confidants kept their silence, others shared what they had been told. In late 1983, one boy had the courage and the empathy to do the right thing. He was an acquaintance of Brent Spaulding who came forward to make a statement to the police. Brent had told him things that distressed the teen, and he needed to get these concerns off his chest. His father took him straight to the police to make a statement. That statement is still maintained today. Soon after the boy made his statement, Brent was admitted to a psychiatric facility. After Eric's murder, Brent had started to act in a manner which people labelled crazy. It could have been legitimate and an indication that Brent was cracking under all of the pressure. However, most people didn't buy that for a second. It was widely believed that Brent's behaviour and subsequent admission to the psychiatric facility was a cover-up. a way of getting him out of the spotlight and providing him with a defence if the case ever made it to prosecution. I don't believe that anyone doubted that Brent was needing help. Enough people had experienced his anger and wild behaviour to doubt that. It would seem, though, that the help Brent needed should have been given long before he ever crossed paths with Eric Cross. After Brent's admittance to the psychiatric facility, the case seemed to die down. People graduated from high school, with many moving away from the Vicksburg area. And the story of Eric and the core group faded.
In 2000s, like 2000, 2001, 2002, there was a cold case in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is a different entity because there's several different police departments depending if it's county or city and stuff like that. So the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's had the case, but then Kalamazoo Police took the case for a while with the cold case unit, which is all retired detectives and police officers and stuff. And they actually were moving the case along, and then all of a sudden the funding was pulled for that cold case unit. But they found evidence that had been hidden and tried to be disposed of and things like that. They have all of that that they brought back, and then all of a sudden the funding's gone. So then that case sat for a while in Kalamazoo. Then it was closed back up, put the lid on the box, ship it back over to Kalamazoo County, and then they put it back up on the shelf. And then Sheriff Ronald Fuller of the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department, he went to Under Sheriff Matches at the time and said, I want you to take a look at this Eric Cross case. I want it closed before you retire. And then Detective Madison was the detective on the case. He was actually the beat cop, a beat cop that showed up to the scene that day in 1983. Yes. So he was there from the moment that this case was first picked up and they thought it was a hit and run, then they realized it was intentional. He was there from that first moment.
You may remember that many people were shocked when upon joining Eric's memorial page, they found out that his murder had not been prosecuted. People felt that they had known exactly what had happened to Eric and who had been involved. They had known it in high school, all of those years ago in 1983. Why had nobody listened? Where were all of the adults who should have been hearing the whispers and stepping in to get to the bottom of things? The parents, the teachers, the counsellors, the school officials. Surely some of these adults must have heard something, known something.
One day we had an assembly at school, and they broke us down. They had us sit in the bleachers by grade, so the 9th graders, 10th graders, 11th, and 12th were all in their own sections, and we were all sitting there, and all of these policemen in uniforms, dress uniforms and stuff, were standing up front with Eric's parents. And basically, they came to talk to us about this, and they wanted to see if they could get kids to come forward. They talked about Eric, and his mom talked and stuff, and I remember it was almost, I will never forget this, because I was, at that time, I would have been a 10th grader, and I remember sitting there facing them, and all of a sudden they said, if you know who did this, if you know who's involved, we need you to come forward and talk to us, reach out to your counselors, reach out to the principal, and they will connect us. Well, it was kind of like the parting of the Red Sea, because As this person is saying this, this man in this uniform, you can actually hear people shuffling to separate from Maybrit and Amber, who were sitting side by side. And it was like we left, there was a gap where people had actually literally moved away from them and kind of looked at them. And that's how a 13 to 17-year-old kid says, they're right there.
With the sad passing of Ted Cross in 2007, Jackie was now left to take on the legacy of her family's fight for justice. By October of 2010, Jackie's attention had shifted to social media, and she decided to set up a Facebook page as a memorial to Eric. Jackie felt that if people in the core group could have a Facebook page, then why shouldn't her big brother? It would be a place where people who had known and loved Eric could come and share their memories of him. At around the same time, and in a moment that might be described as serendipity, a lady by the name of Missy Hatfield was thinking about Eric too. Missy went on Facebook to see if Eric had a memorial page and was glad to see that he did. She had known Eric and Jackie back in high school and had run track with Jackie over the few years they had attended high school together.
I was sick then, and I thought, well, I'm going to go through this Facebook and see what's going on. And I happened to see a memorial page for this person, somebody, random person. And I thought, you know what, I wonder if there's a memorial page for Eric. And so I start looking, and Jackie had just put up a memorial-type page. She wanted people to share memories and, you know, any stories and things like that, positive stuff about her brother, because she wanted to make sure he wasn't forgotten. And it's just so interesting and cool that she had put that up, and it was at the same time that I had slowed down enough in my life to where I took the time to look for him, and she just put it up, and I found it right when she just put it up. And so I'm like, wait a minute. I reached out to her through Messenger, and I said, is this not solved? And she goes, no, it's never been solved. And I said, no one was ever arrested for your brother's murder? She goes, no. And I said, Jackie, I'm so sorry. I said, I'm ashamed of this as someone that came out of that school, because we all knew who did it. I can't believe this has never been solved. And so we talked and for a while, and I said, do you want help getting justice for your brother? And she said, yes. And that's kind of where we took off with the Justice for Eric stuff, was just, you know, by accident, we ran into each other at the same time because we both had him on our minds. And for different reasons. She wanted her brother to be remembered. I wanted to see if anybody did remember her brother. And, you know, so there was a God moment there. I know that not everybody does believe that, but I believe in that wholeheartedly. And once we got going, it was like, you know, just, it was frightening to think that a group of teenagers, one 24-year-old man and a handful of 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-old people could keep the police at bay for 26 years.
Now the foundations for a group who would call themselves Eric's Army were being formed. People from all walks of life, some who had known Eric and Jackie and some who were strangers, all of these people would come together with a common goal, seeking justice for Eric Cross and his family. Under the guidance of Missy Hatfield, Eric's Army became a constant reminder of a decades-old murder in Kalamazoo County. More importantly than that, though, Eric's Army was the reminder of Eric himself, a boy who needed a voice, a boy who still lived on in the hearts of many. It was of the utmost importance to Mary Lou Cross that everything done in her son's name remain above board and fair. That's not to say that Eric's Army hasn't had to be assertive and blunt at times, because it has. The group as a whole, though, are very conscious of fighting their cause within the boundaries of the law. They fight hard, but they fight fair.
We follow the laws. We also don't call them protests. We call them peaceful walks, because we are out there representing Eric and his mom and dad. So we make sure that we have a certain composure about us that makes sure that we don't come across ever as unapproachable or as violent or anything like that. And that's been so important. And I've actually had people get downright nasty and angry with me because I'm like, we don't do that way.
No.
Yeah, we could, but it's only a 5-minute gain of attention. I don't want that. We kind of go at people at times, but the way that people respond to us is like more positive, and more people want to be part of Eric's justice and his community and help. And, you know, we mail posters and decals and stuff all over the world. I've mailed posters and decals to Australia. I've mailed them to England. We have them all over the United States, and even in other, you know, Japan and things like that. We have people that follow through things like your podcast and TV shows and stuff. And it's like, look, that person in another country could even see how this family's hurting and how this family needs justice. And if them just following and asking for a poster that they can hang up or just have or a decal that they could put on their vehicle in another country, it's like, absolutely, we're going to send that to you because we want to spread awareness.
When members of the core group are required to attend court as defendants, Eric's Army are there. Even when the defendant in question doesn't show up, Eric's supporters sit close to the front, all wearing their purple shirts, complete with Eric's name and picture. And there have been a lot of court sessions that needed their attendance. Bill and Brent, in particular, have been in trouble with the law for years.
Yet if you look at his arrest record, he's intimidated witnesses. He's, you know, had weapons. He's had drugs. He's had drunk driving offenses in another county, because Allegan County, which is where him and Bill Cook both like to drive drunk, they put him in jail and then they let him out too. And so it's always like, you know, it's not just centrally located to one little area. It just, these guys, any time Brent comes into contact with anybody, they need to watch their back, because something bad's going to happen if he's around you.
One of the issues that may have been a factor in the cover-up surrounding Eric's murder was the core group standing in the town, or perhaps more accurately, their parents standing. All bar one of the core group's families were part of the town's very lifeblood, with reaches that extended across the church, the school system, and construction and development. It may have felt intimidating and unwise for some potential witnesses to come forward. In situations where keeping quiet means not rocking the boat, remaining silent probably seemed like an easy decision to some.
The Spaldings had kind of a, the myth about those people, because they were such hotheads and just violent type people, the myth became that they were almost like the mafia, the mob, because it was like, don't mess with them because you'll end up like Eric, and don't do this. And I'm like, okay, first of all, if they're that dangerous, then somebody needs to do something so that you're not, so that none of us all fear these people. But secondly, this boy deserves, you know, first and foremost, Eric deserves justice. Second, they need to be off the streets, because are they doing this to other people? Have they done this to other people? To a lot of scared, now grown people, they're dangerous. Then as I got to work more and more with Jackie and more on this case, and I got to know the detective and I got to work with the police a little bit more on the case, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is another urban myth. These people don't have reach. Maybe they did back then because they had connections in the village of Vicksburg. These people are just a family that have, you know, a child that helped murder another child, and they covered it up. So why are so many grown people afraid of these people still in 2019, 2020? It just does not make sense.
In 2015, the tides were starting to turn on Eric's case. After a vigil was held in Vicksburg to remember Eric on what would have been his 49th birthday, it seemed that people were finally taking notice. News crews and their reporters covered the vigil, and after it was broadcast, police received multiple phone calls, one of which contained a key piece of information. According to Paul Matches, who was the Kalamazoo County Undersheriff at the time, that key piece of information shed a very clear light on what had transpired. Paul Matches urged those who were involved to a lesser extent to come forward before they were lumped together with the most culpable. And now for a bit of legal jargon. Under Michigan law, the following is relevant to this case. Any person who conspires together with one or more persons to commit an offence prohibited by law is guilty of the crime of conspiracy, punishable as provided herein. If commission of the offence prohibited by law is punishable by imprisonment for 1 year or more, the person convicted under this section shall be punished by a penalty equal to that which could be imposed if he had been convicted of committing the crime he conspired to commit. So in other words, anyone who is found to have been involved in any facet of Eric's murder, as long as that involvement meets certain criteria, can be charged with conspiracy, which is punishable to the same extent as if they had physically been the one to murder him. Shakespeare once wrote, "Something is rotten in the state of Denmark," and in Kalamazoo County, something was definitely off. The question was being raised, how could a group of youths cover up a murder and walk free for decades? How was what police called a conspiracy of silence perpetuated and upheld without any of the individuals cracking at some point? It seemed highly improbable that a bunch of scared kids could carry the weight of what they had been involved in without one or more of them caving under pressure. In 2017, the Kalamazoo Sheriff's Department, headed by Undersheriff Matches, publicly named the five people they had been suspicious of for years. The people named were Brenton Spaulding, Brian Spaulding Sr., Amber Thomas, Bill Cook, and Tim Martin. Brian Spaulding may have been the key answer to why the group had kept their silence for all of this time. An adult conspiring to help the youths after they had killed Eric. We don't know how many of the core group's parents knew about their children's involvement, or if they did at all. But given that Brian Sr. was named, it wouldn't be much of a stretch to believe that others were too. Tim Martin is not a person that we have talked about thus far, but he was at the keg party with Brent, and he is part of the suspect group. Tim was 24 years old at the time of Eric's murder, and his younger brother was friends with the other members of the core group. I would also like to note the fact that Brent's younger sister, May Britt Spaulding, passed away years ago. She was with the core group at the keg party on the 25th of June 1983. But May Britt's potential knowledge or involvement in the crime is a moot point now that she is no longer living. In late 2017, the Sheriff's Department asked the Kalamazoo Prosecutor's Office to issue 5 open arrest warrants for Brian Sr., Amber, Brent, Bill, and Tim. And the reason for those warrants was murder and conspiracy. The warrants were never executed. Eric's case sat on then Kalamazoo prosecutor Jeff Getting's desk for close to 1.5 years.
If that mistake hadn't been made in the Kalamazoo County Prosecutor's Office, the Attorney General Prosecutor Arando said, if that hadn't happened years ago, all of the people listed as suspects, so all 5 of them, would have already been in prison. So we fought all this time. We're waiting for Schutte to do something. We're waiting for Getting to do something. Neither one of them is making a move. And then we have to go to 2020 to find out. 3 years later, 2 and 3 years later, we got to wait until then to find out, oh, so you purposely tanked Eric's case to cover up your mistake because you don't want it to affect your record in the public's eye because it's political.
Eric's supporters had had enough. They raised money through can drives and were able to put up billboards asking the new Attorney General, Dana Nessel, to take on Eric's case. And in February 2019, the case finally ended up with the Michigan Attorney General's office. Detective Madison and Under-Sheriff Paul Matches had retired in early 2018. These were 2 men who were committed to seeing Eric's case through to prosecution. Paul Matches continues to tirelessly advocate for Eric's family, even in retirement.
He made a promise to Eric's dad before Eric's dad died. Many years before that, he said, I will see this through to the end. I'm not going to leave you guys. And then when Eric's dad died, they got the case full time afterwards, like in 2011 or so, 10 or 11. And so he made Eric's dad that promise back then, and he's keeping his promise. He's a man of his word, I respect him so much. I mean, I can't even begin to explain, how it's been getting to know and work with him and Detective Madison, and I respect them both extremely. They're extremely important in Eric's case and the family because they mean what they say, and they are trying everything they possibly can. And right now, I mean, look, he's retired, and boom, he's right back on top of this case and saying he's right out in front of the cameras, and he's telling them, look, this case isn't closed. We're still working it.
On the 23rd of January 2020, the Attorney General Prosecutor held a meeting with Eric's family and their representatives. At this meeting, facts about the case and the likelihood of prosecution were shared. It was announced that the Attorney General's office would not be prosecuting Eric's case at this point in time. Although prosecutors were confident that they would be successful in a preliminary hearing, they were concerned at where the case would stand after that. Many news outlets started to publish headlines which said that Eric's case was being closed. This is definitely not the case. Eric's case is still very much open and has been put back into the capable hands of the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office. There is a piece of information that the Sheriff's Office is seeking, and when it is found, the case can be handed back to the Attorney General's Office and prosecuted. According to media reports, former Undersheriff Matchis, who had attended the meeting, was livid about the mistakes made by the Kalamazoo Prosecutor's Office. Amber Thomas was, just a few weeks ago, offered a full immunity deal by the Attorney General Prosecutors. The deal meant that Amber would need to explain exactly what happened the night of Eric's murder, including naming the people who were involved. For her trouble, Amber would have walked free with no conviction. Instead, Amber pled the Fifth. And for those who don't know, pleading the Fifth refers to the Fifth Amendment of the US Constitution, which says that citizens of the US cannot be required to give testimony that could be used against them in a court of law. This is a definition that I found regarding pleading the Fifth in a conspiracy case. In the example of a conspiracy trial, a witness may be called upon to testify against alleged co-conspirators. If, by answering questions under oath, that witness implicates themselves in a crime, which prosecutors could later use as evidence in charging them with a crime, they may plead the Fifth. So by pleading the Fifth, Amber has implied that she won't answer questions because if she does, the answers will show that she was somehow involved in the murder and or cover-up of Eric Cross. Each year, on the weekend closest to the date that Eric was killed, Eric's army holds a Walk Eric Home event. The walk covers the route that Eric would have walked on that fateful night in 1983. The event is a way of saying that, unlike that night back in 1983, there are now people who stand with Eric and symbolically walk him home safely. Anyone listening to this podcast is welcome to follow Eric's page. Just search Justice for Eric Sterling Cross on Facebook. I can't begin to tell you the blood, sweat and tears that the members of Eric's army and the members of law enforcement put in to fight for Eric and his family. Although it has been 37 years since Eric was murdered, it is important to remember this. All it takes is one person. One person to fight for a loved one. One member of law enforcement to review a case. One member of the public to give some pertinent information. One person to take that immunity deal and to live their life with a clear conscience. No amount of time makes Eric's death okay. No amount of denial makes a person less guilty, and no amount of closure will ever replace what the Cross family has lost. However, we can't underestimate the healing that closure will bring. There is an immunity deal waiting if Bill Cook would like to preserve his freedom and take it. Amber knocked it back, so this is Bill's chance to step up and do what should have been done in 1983. Immunity deals are a rare and valuable commodity, and rejecting one is not something that should be done lightly. If anyone listening has information about Eric's case, then you may be the one to finally provide much-needed closure for Eric's mother Mary Lou and for his sister Jackie. The numbers to call with information are the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office on 269-383-8821. Or Silent Observer on 269-343-2100. As we finish up this episode, it would be nice if we could all think of Ted Cross for a moment. On that terrible morning when Ted woke up, walked outside and had his life shattered, Ted was able to do one last thing for Eric. He insisted that the police collect every scrap of evidence at that scene. Not just the clothes, watch and wallet, every last piece. Even though the police at the time believed Eric's death to be accidental, they agreed to Ted's request, and a collection of crime scene evidence carried out to placate a grieving father ensured that Eric's case would be as solid as possible. Thank you so much to Missy Hatfield for your time and for sharing so many memories. And to you, the listener, thank you so much for listening to Eric's story. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help me grow my podcast by leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whichever app you're using, I would be ever so grateful. Have a wonderful day and thank you for coming to Crime Valley.